It's June to Yesterday, showcasing programs from the Golden Age of Radio. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Coming up in this hour, horror. Later on, it's The Haunting Hour from 1945, but first, a story from Bram Stoker, adapted on the Hall of Fantasy, called The Judge's House, from April 6th, 1947, on CBS.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Granite Furniture Company, with stores in Sugar House, Murray, and Provo, presents...
The Hall of Fantasy. Welcome to the Hall of Fantasy. Welcome to the series of radio dramas dedicated to the supernatural, the unusual, and the unknown. Come with me, my friends. We shall ascend to the world of the unknown and forbidden, down to the depths where the veil of time is lifted and the supernatural reigns as king. Come with me and listen to the tale of The Judge's House.
The Granite Furniture Company brings you the Hall of Fantasy. Listen now to original tales of the imagination and some of the classics of the supernatural as we take you down the corridors of the Hall of Fantasy to the mysterious realms of the unknown. These are stories of eerie and fantastic thrills brought to you by your friends at the Granite Furniture Stores. And now for tonight's story, a radio adaptation by Bob Olson of Bram Stoker's story entitled The Judge's House. Justice. Peace. How can we be certain of either when hatred burns unchecked, even beyond the grave? I am Malcolm Lane. This is my story. I want to tell it to you while there is still time. I watched them carry the parcels into the judge's house. Mrs. Whittam, whom I had engaged as my housekeeper for the next 3 months, was directing the activity. She was an amusing little character. I had to promise that she wouldn't have to stay in the house after it began to get dark. The upholsterer's man was coming up the pathway with a cart and a new bed. Mrs. Whittam had insisted on this one new piece of furniture because, as she put it...
A bed that just hasn't been aired for 50 years is not fit for young bodies to lie on.
And she was right, of course. But my head was too full of plans for study to worry about such details as my living quarters. As for the tales about the harsh old judge whose house this had once been, I had only a mild enthusiasm. He must have been quite a character, though, to make an entire village fear him and his house, even 50 years after his death. Mrs. Whittam was positive there was something about the old place, though she nor anyone else quite knew what it was. The consensus of opinion, however, was that they would not take all the money in Drinwater's bank to spend an hour here alone. But Mrs. Whittam startled me with a very rational statement.
The place is full of rats, and rats is bogies, just the same as bogies is rats.
That explanation suited me very well, for as I said once before, my head was full of plans to study. Examinations were coming up soon, and I had paid 3 months' rent in this old house, so that I would be assured of peace and quiet while I prepared for them. The only mysteries I'm interested in, Mrs. Whittam, are those of harmonical progression and elliptical functions. They're mystery enough for me.
Not that you won't find company here, Mr. Lane. I've already cleaned all of 50 years of dust from everything. Oh, but that wainscot in this room must be hundreds of years old. And you'll find creaky doors aplenty, and loose flats all over, ready to flap in the wind. And bureau drawers that stick and then fall down in the middle of the night.
And don't forget the rats.
No, Mr. Lane. Don't forget the rats.
The workmen were all gone, and but for the busy little figure, the housekeeper, I was alone. It was for this that I'd taken the tiresome ride to Benchurch, a remote little town that had all the attractions of a desert. It was drawing close to evening as Mrs. Whittam was unpacking the last hamper, and I could see that she was beginning to cast worried glances about as the shadows began to creep into the corners of this huge dining room I'd chosen for my living quarters. Oh, you may go now, Mrs. Whittam. It's getting dark in here, and I'm sure you're anxious to get home. You've done well with this old room. I shall reward you with complete possession of this house for the last 2 months of my tenancy. 3 or 4 weeks will be all I'll need, and I'd hate to see that rent money go to waste.
Thank you kindly, sir, but I wouldn't stay here
I know, for all the money in Drinkwater's bank. I'm really grateful, for I do want to be alone. And if you were not so opposed to it, I might be tempted to accept your company.
Ah, you young gentleman. You fear nothing, and I'm certain you'll get all the solitude you need here. Good night, sir. You'll find your supper beneath the cloth.
Good night, Mrs. Whittam. Oh, yes. Yes, this was comfort. After I'd finished my supper, I cleared the great oak table and got my books out. Then when I'd put fresh wood in the fire and trimmed the lamp, I sat down to a spell of hard work. I hardly looked up from my books until nearly 11 o'clock, at which time I threw some more wood in the fire and indulged in one of my most deeply ingrained habits, that of tea drinking. I thoroughly enjoyed tea and drank it this night with a sense of real enjoyment. Soon the new wood I had thrown on the fire began to crackle, and the new flame threw quaint shadows about the great old room. And as I sat there sipping my tea, I reveled in the complete sense of isolation. Then, for the first time, I noticed the noise of the rats. Strange, I hadn't heard them before. Maybe they're just getting used to me. But they're bold enough now. How busy they were. What strange noises they made. Up and down the old wainscot they went, and over the ceiling and over the floor, racing and gnawing and scratching. There were so many of them that I'd have sworn that if they set their strength to it, they could have carried the house away. I had a smile when I recalled the words of Mrs. Whittem. Rats is bogies, and bogies is rats. The stimulation of the tea gave me a sense of security, and I grabbed the lamp to take a good look around the room. Strange why such a beautiful old place should have been so neglected for all this time. The carving on the oak panels of the wainscot was fine indeed, and that around the doors and windows was of rare merit. I saw some old pictures on the wall next to the fireplace, but they were coated so thick with dust that I couldn't distinguish any of their details, even though I did hold the lamp high above my head. Now and then I would get a quick start as the light fell upon the old walls and disclosed the glittering eyes of a rat as he would stick his face out of a hole or a crack. In an instant, it would disappear with a squeak and a scamper. Another object that struck me as odd was the rope of a great alarm bell that hung in the corner of the room on the right-hand side of the fireplace. After my inspection tour, I sat in a high-backed chair that was near the fireplace and sipped from another cup of tea. For a while, I thought the noise of the rats would drive me to distraction, but that eased off and I became accustomed to it, the same as a person gets used to the roar of water when he camps beside a stream. Soon I was so engrossed in a mathematical problem that I forgot everything else in the world. But since the solution to the problem came stubbornly, I looked up and was surprised to see that the fire had fallen to a dull red glow. There was a sudden quiet, the strange hush that comes in the hour before dawn. I became aware for the first time that the noise of the rats had ceased. When it had happened, I couldn't remember. Something instinctive told me that it had been in the last few moments, and that it had been sudden. I looked up, and what I saw was a most amazing thing. For there on the high-backed chair sat an enormous rat, staring at me through deadly, malignant eyes. I tried to frighten it away, but it didn't stir. I made a motion as if to throw something at it. But it only bared its teeth angrily, and its cruel eyes shone all the more bright. I'd grabbed the poker from the hearth and was going to kill the creature. But before I could reach it, that enormous rat jumped to the floor, and with a squeak that sounded like a consummate hate of the whole world, scampered up the rope of the alarm bell and disappeared in the darkness. Then, as if by a signal, the noise of the other rat started all over again. By this time, I gave up working my problem and bartered it for some much-needed sleep. It was Mrs. Whittem who woke me as she came in to make up the room.
You're much paler this morning, Miss Delane.
I am.
You shouldn't stay up so late with your work. It isn't good for you. But tell me, how did you spend the night? I was certainly glad to see you.
Alive? Oh, yes, that was quite all right, Mrs. Whittem. The something didn't worry me too much. But the rats certainly held themselves at camp meeting. There was one that sat up in that chair by the fireplace and wouldn't go away until I chased him with a poker. It was the biggest old devil I've ever seen.
Old devil? Maybe it was the old devil.
I only meant
Never that... you mind, sir. Many a true word is spoken in jest.
Well, pardon me, Mrs. Whittem. I didn't mean to be rude. But the thought of the old devil himself sitting in that chair last night struck me as being rather funny.
And it's a good thing you can laugh. But all the same, if I were to spend the night here tonight, oh, heaven forbid, I'd make sure I was ready for him.
That night, the rats put on an earlier show, for their scamperings began almost as soon as I'd finished with my supper. The cursed creatures seemed to get on my nerves, and I sat there and puffed on my pipe. Well, they squealed and scratched and gnawed. They seemed to grow bolder by the minute. By now, they were coming to the chinks and cracks in the wall until their eyes shone like miniature lamps when the firelight struck them. They'd even make bold sallies under the floor, and I'd have to frighten them away by pounding on the table with my fist. That was how I passed the early part of that night. Despite it, I became more and more engrossed in my studies. And then, a strange sensation coursed through me. For there it was again. Instinctively, I grabbed the handiest object I could find, a book, and flung it at the baleful little beast. But the book was too hastily aimed, and the huge rat didn't stir. So once again, I went into the poker routine. And once again, it put up the rope of the alarm bell. I tried to follow its flight more closely this time, but before I could see where it went, it had been swallowed up in the shadows. And just as it happened last night, as soon as the big rat had gone, the others resumed their activity. I looked at my watch and found that it was very close to midnight. I built up the fire and brewed myself a pot of tea. I tried to get back to my work, but I suddenly became curious to know where the rat had disappeared to. For I was certain that tomorrow I would most likely get myself a rat trap. I gathered all my books about me and put them in a handy position for throwing. Then I took the rope of the alarm bell and placed the end of it upon the table underneath the lamp, where there would be plenty of light on it. As I picked up the rope, I was amazed how pliable and strong it was. Ideal, I thought, for hanging a man. Soon my preparations were complete. Now, this time, my friend, I intend to learn more about you. Once again, I was hard at my work, and the noise of the rats was forgotten. But just as suddenly as before, I was aroused by that same sense of startling silence. I was conscious of a slight movement in the rope at my elbow. Without stirring, I checked to see if my pile of books was in easy reach. It was. I cast my glance at the rope just in time to see the huge rat drop from it to the back of the high oak chair. I grabbed a book and hurled it. With amazing agility, the rat sprang aside and dodged it. I threw a second and a third, but each time it managed to dodge my battery. It was almost funny, almost. Finally, when I was down to the last book, I took careful aim, and as I did this, the rat squeaked and seemed afraid. I let the book fly. It struck the rat with a resounding thud. It gave out a shrill, terrified shriek, and running up the back of the chair, made a desperate leap. And with the speed of a bolt of lightning, ran up the bell rope. The lamp rocked with a strain, but it didn't topple. Then I saw the rat leap to a molding and disappear through the hole in one of the big pictures that hung on the wall. I made a mental note of the exact spot. Third picture from the fireplace, huh? I'll remember that and have Mrs. Whittem scrub it clean the first thing tomorrow morning. I began to pick up the books I had thrown at the rat. As I did so, I took a good look at their titles. Conic sections. Mr. Rat doesn't seem to mind that. Neither did he. This one on cycloidal oscillations. And this one on thermodynamics he dodged very neatly. Oh. Here's the book that got him. As I looked at the title of the book that had finally hit the huge rat, I could feel a pallor spread across my face. For the title of that book was The Holy Bible.
Mr. Lane, this is Dr. Thornhill.
Dr. Thornhill, are you ill, Mrs. Whittem?
Your pardon, Mr. Lane, but Mrs. Whittem wanted me to come up here and have a talk with you.
A talk? Well, in that case, let me prepare some tea for you.
Oh, please don't. That's one of the things I came to talk to you about. Mrs. Whittem thinks you drink more strong tea than is good for you. She tells me also that you put in quite long hours at your studies.
Mrs. Whittem, I engaged you as a housekeeper, not as a guardian.
Oh, please, Mr. Lane, I didn't
mean to. As a matter of fact, Lane, she didn't mean to have me talk to you at all. That was my idea.
I see. Well, now that you're here, what do you want me to do?
Leave this house.
Well, even if I could see the reason for it, I doubt if I would. But as for the tea and late hours, I might be able to give them up. Would it make you feel any better, Mrs. Whittem, if I promised not to study after 1 o'clock tonight?
Yes, if you promise.
Then I promise.
I advise you, not as a total stranger to your problem, Mr. Lane. I was a student once myself, you know.
Of course. Shall we shake on a doctor?
Fine. Now, if you will, I wish you'd tell me what you've noticed in this house.
Well, it's just as I've told Mrs. Whittem. I'd be working late, and I'd suddenly... And when I looked to see which book it was that had struck the rat, the devil, as Mrs. Whittem calls it, I was amazed to find that it was the Holy Bible. There now. Please, Mrs. Whittem, you're not hurt.
Now, Mr. Lane, you say the rat always went up the rope of that alarm bell?
Always.
I suppose you know what that rope is?
No, why?
It's the very rope the hangman used to execute the victims of the judge's hatred.
Oh, no.
Now, Mrs. Whittem, there's no reason to get upset about this, really.
Doctor, you shouldn't put such horrible thoughts in poor Mr. Lane's mind. He has enough to unseat him already.
I did it for a definite purpose. Mr. Lane, I want you to fix your attention on that rope. Now, I know you're sound of mind and body, but hard work and long hours and this suggestion of the devil, especially in this lonely old house, can do things to the mind. Now, I don't mean this as any offense, but if you should find yourself having, well, hallucinations or some unexplainable fright, I want you to pull that rope. It'll give us some kind of a warning in the village. We might be able to be of some help.
Well, thank you, Doctor. I'll do that. I may get stuck with a problem.
Fine. Goodbye, Mr. Lane, and, well, I wouldn't be surprised if Benchurch hears the alarm bell from the judge's house tonight.
I didn't quite share the doctor's views, but just the same, I caught myself staring at the bell rope. The more I stared, the more restless I became, and every now and then my mind would conjure up the vision of some wretched victim dangling from the end of it. But that line of thinking would have me out of my mind in a hurry. Mrs. Whittem had made the place neat and homey. I wandered over to one of the big windows and flung it open. I was surprised to find that a sharp wind had come up, a very cold wind for April. It was more than a sharp wind, really, for it was carrying a storm. Little drops of rain began to pelt me in the face until soon it came a thing of fury. I bolted the shutters and built up the fire with some fresh wood. I was uncomfortable and was only vaguely conscious of the reason. Suddenly I knew. The rats were quiet tonight. It gave me a slight case of the jitters, and I instinctively took a hasty glance at the bell rope. The rope was quite still. I wanted a hot cup of tea, but remembering my promise to Mrs. Whittem, I desisted. Instead, I set up the great oak table and opened my books. Soon I had started a problem, and the noise of the rats began. For the first time since I had taken up residence in the judge's house, I was glad to hear those rats. I had worked for an hour or so and suddenly became conscious of the furious storm outside. I was thankful that I didn't have to be out of it. The faint movement of the bell rope compelled me to walk over to it and take it in my hand. I saw nothing. It had only been the wind, and the rope was rising and falling gently with each new gust of air, which caused the bell to sway back and forth a little. That rope had a deadly fascination to it. I wondered why the judge wanted such a grisly memento in his house. The thought of it sent a chill through me. Or was it a thought? Didn't I sense a tremor along that rope? I couldn't be sure, but at that moment I remembered the picture. I walked over to the table, picked up the lamp, and approached the spot where I'd seen the picture the night before. I counted out the pictures until I came to the third one from the fireplace. Even before I raised the lamp, I could see that Mrs. Whittem had washed it clean as I had told her to do. Then what I saw... What I saw gave me such a start that I nearly dropped the lamp. My knees almost gave way beneath me, and I was conscious of huge beads of perspiration that were forming on my forehead. Just looking at it made me tremble like an aspen leaf. The picture seemed fairly to leap out at me. For there, dressed in his scarlet and ermine robes with a judge, with his merciless, evil face, his sensual mouth, and a nose that was shaped like the beak of a bird of prey. His face had a cadaverous culling. It was a ghastly picture. But it was the eyes that really made me go cold. For those eyes were... And heaven help me if I'm going mad. Those eyes were the exact duplicate of the evil eyes of the great rat. The picture had been painted in this very room. I began to compare the two, and as my eyes swept the room, they were suddenly riveted to the judge's chair. For there, with a rope hanging behind it, sat the huge rat with the judge's eyes. And the hatefulness was now intensified with a fiendish leer. Never did the wind howl so. This had to stop. I wanted some tea, but I didn't take any. Doctor had been quite right. The nerve must have been getting drawn pretty taut. Strange, too, because I never was in better health. Well, no tea. We'll substitute some brandy. Let's see. Then, I had a stiff glass of the brandy and went back to work. The rats were at it again, and I was glad to hear them, for they had become a sort of symbol of normalcy. The storm raised such a fury that I was unaware of anything else. But once, during a sharp, silent lull, I heard another sound, a faint, squeaking noise. I listened for it again and soon detected it. It was coming from the corner of the room where the bell rope hung. At first, I thought it was just the motion of the rope in the storm, but I looked up and saw something in the dim light that made me all the more positive that I was going mad. For there was the great rat, clinging to the rope and gnawing at it. I could see the lighter coloring where the bare strands were exposed. Just then, the rat finished its job, and the rope fell to the floor with a thud. For a moment, the huge rat just hung there like a tassel. It was then that I realized what had happened. My only contact with the village was now gone. I don't know why, but I rushed to the lamp on the table, snatched off the shade, and ran over to the picture of the judge. A chill of horror went through me. But I think I must have expected what I saw. It seemed more like a confirmation than a shock. For there in the center of the picture was a great patch of brown canvas, as clean and as fresh as the day it had been drawn over the frame. And where the portrait of the judge himself had been, there was nothing. I heard a sound behind me. When I turned around, I really got the palsy. I suddenly became incapable of movement. I could hardly think. I had been prepared to see most anything, but what was there? For there in the judge's high-backed chair, with his black cap in his hand, his ermine robes fixed about him with a smile of triumph, twisting his cruel mouth, was the judge himself. As the clock struck the hour, it seemed to beat the blood right out of my heart. At the 12th stroke, the judge placed the black cap on his head and walked deliberately over to the place where the piece of bell rope lay in a heap on the floor. He picked it up and drew it through his hands as one would a valuable fur pelt. Then he began to knot one end, fashioning it into a noose. He tightened it and tested it with his foot. All this time, he never took his horribly cruel eyes from my face. I began to feel trapped. For some reason, I could barely move. I could only watch as he started to move along the table toward me. And then with a quick movement, he threw the noose at me, as if to ensnare me in it. It missed. He raised it again, never once taking those hateful eyes from my face. Once more the noose came, flying toward me. Once more, with some last ounce of strength, I dodged it. The room seemed flooded with light. The lamp had suddenly flared up high. I looked about the room and was astonished to see the shiny little eyes of the rats as they peered out the cracks and chinks in the wall. I looked up at the bell rope, my lost and last hope of warning the village. It was covered with the little fellows. Funny thing, but those rats were the only thing that gave me even the slightest sense of comfort. For as the rats clambered along the bell rope, the bell itself began to sway, and I heard a tiny sound, yes, very tiny, as the clapper touched the bell itself. It was only a whisper of a sound, but it would grow louder in time. Or would it? At this sound, the judge looked up, and a scowl of terrible anger came to his face. His eyes were like red-hot coals, and he stamped his foot so that the house seemed to shake. The rats kept running up and down the rope as if they were conscious that it was a race against time. Now the judge was approaching me with a noose in his hand. As he came closer, there seemed to be something paralyzing in his presence, and I stood as rigid as a corpse. Suddenly, I felt the judge's icy fingers against the skin of my throat. He was adjusting the rope about my neck. Then he picked me up and stood me on the high oak chair and put his hand on the swaying end of the bell rope. As he raised his hand, I was conscious of my little rat friends fleeing through the hole in the ceiling. They were my last hope. I stood there on the chair and couldn't move a muscle. Now that my last hope seemed gone, I wanted the judge to hurry and get it over with. Soon he'd tied the end of the rope just about my neck, the dangling end of the bell rope. Then he jumped down to the floor and looked at me with those eyes that hated me so. The smile of diabolical triumph seemed to wreathe him in horror. I began to wonder about hangings. I wondered how long it would take, whether the doctor in the village could possibly reach me in time. For I knew that I would soon be sounding the alarm bell. I even wondered what kind of a shadow I'd cast on the wall as I dangled from the end of the rope in this grotesque candlelight. But I didn't wonder for long. Because suddenly, the judge grabbed the chair on which I was standing when the sudden movement jerked it out from under me.
So runs the tale of The Judge's House. Remember to join us next week at the same time for another journey down the corridors of the Hall of Fantasy.
Tonight's program was adapted from the story by Bram Stoker entitled The Judge's House. Heard in tonight's program were Dick Thorne as Malcolm Lane, Beth Calder as Mrs. Woodham, and Mel Wyman as the Doctor. Musical background was provided by Earl Donaldson. The technical supervisor was Nephi Sorensen. This program was written by Bob Olson and produced and directed by Richard Thorne. Remember, be with us again next Sunday night on call at 8:30 p.m. when the Granite Furniture Stores in Sugar House, Murray, and Provo will take you on another journey down the corridors of the Hall of Fantasy.
The Hall of Fantasy, on Tuned to Yesterday from the 6th of April, 1947, on CBS. The short story by Bram Stoker, The Judge's House, was first published in 1891 in the holiday issue of the Illustrated Sporting and Dramatic News out of London called Holly Leaves. It made its way to the States in pulp form when it was printed in Weird Tales magazine in March of 1935. You're listening to an hour of horror on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now time for The Haunting Hour with the story Ptolemy's Grave, an NBC syndicated episode heard in 1945.
Stay where you are. Do not break the stillness of this moment, for this is a time of mystery, a time when imagination is free and moves forward swiftly, silently. This is the Haunting Hour. Ptolemy's Grave. Over the tomb which held the mummy of Ptolemy III, these words were written: Death to him who disturbs the everlasting resting place of these sacred remains. 2 weeks ago, William Cartwright, a famous Egyptologist, defied this curse. He bought the mummy, had it sent to his home. That same day, he slowly walked down the stairs from his upstairs study. His wife, Martha, heard his familiar footsteps in the hall, over the stairs, but she did not know that her husband was then walking into a nothingness, that he would completely disappear, leaving no trace of his whereabouts. Now, it is 2 o'clock the following morning. The Cartwright house is still. A taut feeling of mystery hovers in the air. Martha Cartwright is dreaming of her missing husband. And in her dream, as in her waking hours, she is haunted by the fear of Ptolemy's curse.
William? William?
Martha, I hear you. Do you hear me?
William, where are you?
Downstairs.
I'm downstairs, Martha.
Downstairs? Here in our house?
In our study. Come to the study, Martha.
I'll come. I'll come, William.
Here in the study, Martha. Come to the study.
Yes, William. The study. I'm here, William. Here at the study door.
Look for me.
Where are you, William?
Look for me, Martha.
Darkness. Can't see you.
Come over the carpet to the mummy case. To the mummy case. The mummy of Ptolemy the Third.
Yes. Yes, William, I'm here.
Look at the mummy closely, Martha.
I am looking, William.
Don't you see?
All I see is a strange, misty light. Like a halo. Shining, glowing about the mummy.
Lean forward then, Martha. Look closely. Look closely.
No, I can't. I can't.
You must, Martha. Look at the mummy's face.
The face?
Can't you see, Martha? Can't you see what it is?
No. No, it's just... I don't know what you mean.
The features, Martha. Don't you see anything different about the features?
Gray, shrunken, shriveled skin. Gray and horrible.
But the lips, the forehead, the eyes, don't you see, Martha? Have you forgotten so soon?
Forgotten? I remember you, William. I'll always remember you.
But if the eyes were open, if they were open, Martha, could you... Look, now they are open, Martha.
Yeah. I see. Now I see. William, the mummy had your face.
Yes, Martha, that's it. The mummy and I, we're the same, Martha. The same.
The same? We are!
Hello?
Dr. John Crandall.
This is he. Who's this, Martha?
Yes, John. Look, I had to call you. I'm so afraid. I thought the operator could never get my call through.
Yes, I know. The long-distance lines are pretty well tied up. What's the matter, Martha? What time is it?
It's very late, but I couldn't wait till morning. John, something's happened.
Have they found William?
Yes. I don't know. Look, John, I need you badly. I think I'm going out of my mind.
Oh, nonsense. What happened?
I've got to see you, John, please, tonight. I'm asking you this not only as a patient, but as a friend.
But I can't come into town tonight, Martha. You're all right. It's just your imagination.
Oh, no. I thought it was a dream.
Well, I've got a job here that's got to be finished, but I can leave the hospital early in the morning.
Come as soon as you can, please.
I promise, Martha. Now, take hold of yourself. Control is the word. Remember.
I'll try, John. I'll try. Mr. Kroll.
Yes?
This is Martha Cartwright, Mr. Kroll. I'm sorry to wake you up, if I did.
Oh, no. That is all right.
I've got to see you first thing in the morning. It's important. It's urgent.
Why, of course, Mrs. Cartwright.
Will you come here to my house at 9 o'clock?
At 9. I will be there. But what is the trouble?
It's about that mummy you sold my husband.
Oh, I see.
Don't fail me, Mr. Kroll.
No, I will be there without fail.
Mrs. Cartwright?
You're Mr. Kroll.
Yes.
Come in, please.
Thank you.
You're the gentleman who sold my husband the mummy, aren't you?
Yes.
Well, I want you to take it away.
Take it away?
Yes, immediately. You're here, right away.
But, Mrs. Cartwright...
I'm sorry. I'm terribly upset.
No, I understand.
How soon can you take it away?
Perhaps tomorrow morning.
Oh.
But what do you want me to do with it?
I don't know. I don't care. Sell it or give it away. Do anything you want with it.
Well, that will be very difficult. You see, one reason your husband was able to buy it was... Well, perhaps we'd better not discuss it right now.
You mean it's cursed?
Yes. Misfortune has always been attached to it.
Do you believe in this curse?
I have specialized in the art and civilization of the pharaohs for 20 years. My experience has taught me to respect their ideas. Yes, Mrs. Cartwright. I believe in the curse.
Can you tell me what the curse says?
Death to him who disturbs these sacred remains. A death of torture, of maddening pain. Death in its strangest form.
And now that my husband is dead, I may be the next victim? You must take it back. Please, Mr. Kroll, I can't have it here another night. I haven't slept for days. I can't keep my eyes open, but I'm afraid to sleep.
Why don't you leave this house until tomorrow?
I can't. I'm expecting my doctors.
Then perhaps you will be able to take a nap before he arrives.
Perhaps. Well, thank you, Mr. Kroll. You'll take it tomorrow, then.
Yes. Goodbye, Mrs. Cartwright.
William.
Death in its strangest form.
Not you, William.
A death of torture, of maddening pain.
They couldn't, William, they couldn't.
Martha, do you hear me?
William.
Yes, Martha.
Where are you?
I'm in the study, Martha. You remember where you saw me last night?
No. Oh, it was a dream last night. You were in the mummy case, then it couldn't be.
Yes, I'm still there, Martha. Come and you'll see.
No, William, I couldn't go there again. No.
But I haven't disappeared. I'm here in the house. You want to be with me? I'm here in the study, Martha.
I can't come to you. I'm afraid.
Afraid of me, your husband?
Yes, William, I know. I'll come to you.
Down here, Martha, in the study.
I'm coming to you, William. I'll do anything you say. But don't make me look at the face.
You must, Martha.
No, William, I'll do anything. Not that, please. No, not that. No.
Martha.
Please don't make me. Will, please, I can't do it.
Martha, wake up. It's John. No. John Crandall.
I'm going to die. I know I'm going to die. I don't want to look at that face again. Please don't make me, William. Please, please.
Martha.
John Crandall.
You're walking in your sleep, Martha. I'm sorry I slapped you, but I had to wake you.
Oh, you're here, John. Thank heavens you're here.
Is there anything left that you haven't told me, Martha?
That's all I know, John. I'm not going crazy, am I?
No, Martha. As a psychiatrist, I can tell you that you're not going crazy. This is all the result of the shock of Will's disappearance.
But that doesn't explain the curse, John. What about...
Oh, nonsense. Civilized people don't believe in curses. Ghost statements were inscribed on tombs to frighten away grave robbers.
So hard for me to believe that now.
Martha, I want you to make an experiment with me.
What?
Let's go into the study together and look at the mummy.
Oh, no,
but
I can't.
You've got to. It's the only way you can overcome your fear. Now, just let me prove that it's only your imagination and nothing more.
Please,
no. If you want me to help you, Martha, you have to help me, too. Come.
All right.
That's it. Here's the study. Where's the light switch?
John, wait. Don't turn on the light.
But, Martha,
it's there, John. You see it? You see that misty light?
It's just the moon coming through the blinds.
No, it's the mummy. Look at it.
The mummy?
You see it? That gray light that shines around it. I'm not sleeping, John. I'm here with you. And look at that face. Look closely, John.
I am, Martha.
You see that face? William's face? As though it were dead for centuries? Is this a nightmare, too?
No, it's not a nightmare. I see it.
And that mummy is William's body. It's the curse of Ptolemy the Third. But you laughed at John. You laughed.
Martha.
Now William's gone. He's dead.
Martha, please.
And I'll be cursed after John was.
You don't believe
that. I do. Why didn't he believe it when they told him? Now it's too late, don't you see? Now I'll die as William died. Because now the mummy belongs to me.
Dr. Cartwright, a famous Egyptologist, purchased a mummy called Ptolemy the Third, despite the fact that it was known to be cursed. The same day, he vanished. Now his wife has been suffering from the delusion that the mummy has acquired Cartwright's features. In fact, is Cartwright. Dr. Crandall, a psychoanalyst and a friend of the Cartwrights, has tried to disprove this, only to find that he, too, notices a strange resemblance. Now, we find Dr. Crandall attending Mrs. Cartwright in a hospital.
It's daylight, isn't it?
Yes. How do you feel?
Better. What happened to me?
Well, you were suffering from lack of sleep, Martha, and your nerves were so unstrung that I thought it best to bring you here for a while.
Do you believe in the curse now, John? After what you saw?
No.
But you saw the same thing I did?
Yes.
How do you explain it?
I'm not sure that I can explain it yet, Martha. But after I brought you here, I went back to the house again to look at the mummy.
And?
It was gone.
Gone? Oh, I suppose Mr. Kroll called for it.
Who is Mr. Kroll?
He's the man through whom William bought the mummy. I asked him to take it away.
I see. Well, I'm going to leave you now, Martha. There are several things I want to take care of. But I'll be back this evening, and I want you to come with me to Mr. Kroll's place.
Why?
I want to see that mummy again.
Oh, but John, why must I do that?
Are you still afraid of the curse?
Yes.
Well, I still intend to prove to you that there is no such thing. I'm going to buy that mummy.
Good evening, Mr. Kroll.
Oh, Mrs. Cartwright. And...
This is Dr. John Crandall.
Oh, good evening.
How do you do, sir? Mrs. Cartwright brought me here so that I could see the mummy of Ptolemy III.
Of course, of course. May I ask why you wish to see it?
I'm interested in buying it.
I've tried to convince him that it's cursed, Mr. Kroll, but he doesn't want to believe it.
Many men have refused to believe it. It is only fair that we inform those who intend to buy, and the rest is entirely up to them. Now, if you step this way, please, the mummy is in my workshop.
Thank you. I notice you have many other mummies here, don't you, Mr. Kroll?
Oh, yes. I am known as an expert in repairing them. They are sent from museums and collectors all over the world.
And which is Ptolemy III?
In this sarcophagus right here.
Will you open it?
Why, of course, certainly.
Now, just a moment, Martha. Don't go away. I want you to look at it.
John!
It's very important.
There. There you are, sir. There it is.
Martha, is that the mummy we looked at last night? You see, I'm not sure. I saw it for only a few minutes.
It looks the same, but...
But what?
The faces... I mean, the features are not so familiar.
How do you mean?
This one doesn't look like William.
Perhaps the light is too sharp here. Do you think you could turn the lights off for a second, Mr. Kroll?
No, Mr. Kroll, no, I'm afraid.
Martha, you know I'm not trying to hurt you any more than you've already been hurt by this whole affair. But I must get you to believe that there is no such thing as a curse of this kind. If you don't do as I say, your condition may grow even worse, beyond my control. Is that clear?
Yes.
Now, Mr. Kroll, will you turn off the light?
Of course.
Are you looking at the mummy in that sarcophagus, Martha?
Yes.
Do you see anything now?
No. So pitch black, I can't see anything at all. Nothing.
I see.
John, you know I haven't been imagining all this. You...
What is it, Martha?
Over there. Look near that other wall. Face? That's Williams, just as we saw it last night, John. With that glow all around it. And it's moving. Look, it's moving. John, make him turn on the light. John!
Mr. Kroll, will you turn on the light? Please, hurry.
Why, certainly.
Oh. Oh, John.
All right, Martha, all right. We'll get you out of here. Will you open the door, Mr. Kroll?
Why, of course, Doctor.
And could I ask you to get Mrs. Cartwright a glass of water?
A pleasure, I'm sure.
Martha, listen to me carefully. I've got to explain quickly. As soon as you leave here, go straight to the nearest telephone and call the police. Tell them to come here immediately.
I don't understand.
I know now that William was murdered.
What?
Yes, Kroll killed him, and I'm going to stay here with him until the police arrive.
I beg your pardon. I have the water.
Thank you. Now, drink this, Martha, and take the pill I just gave you.
Yes.
That's it. Now I think you'd better go home, and don't forget what I told you.
Yes, John, I'll go home. Goodbye, Mr. Kroll.
Goodbye, madam.
Oh, it's terrible, sir. She's completely obsessed with the fear of that mummy, and it's destroying her.
She loved her husband very much, I'm sure.
Of course, of course. But more than anything else, it's her insane fear of that curse.
And is that the reason you want to purchase the mummy, Dr. Crandall?
Precisely.
In that case, maybe I can help you.
You can?
Yes, let us talk about it. But first, would you like to have a drink? I notice you are rather fatigued after what just has happened.
Yes, I guess I could stand something. Will you join me?
Why should I leave myself out? Why, of course, I have some very fine old spirits here. And now, there we are. I hope...
What was that?
What?
Is there somebody else in your workroom? I thought I heard a noise from there.
Well, there is nobody there that I know of. No, no. It must be your imagination, Doctor.
Oh.
Perhaps you yourself can take one of those pills you just administered to Mrs. Cartwright.
Yes, she has been a very trying patient, I'll admit.
So, well, to her early recovery.
Thank you, sir.
Hey, dear, there is nothing quite like it, is there, eh, Doctor?
Yes, it's very fine, I must say. Now, I don't like to hurry you, Mr. Cole, but I'm very much interested in your idea to help Mrs. Cartwright.
Well, let us start at the beginning. When you first came into the shop with Mrs. Cartwright and she looked at the mummy, she did not see anything about it that frightened her. Is that right?
Right.
But when you suggested that we turn off the lights, it was then, for the first time, that she was aware of her, well, shall we say, her hallucination.
And what do you suggest?
I suggest that she have the mummy return to her house and then have her practice looking at it while the lights are on. And in this way, she might forget the hallucinations of seeing her husband's face.
I suppose she is not suffering from hallucinations,
what?
Mr. Crowe.
Well, you yourself saw what a change came over her when the lights were turned off.
But she was not frightened by the mummy you originally showed her.
No?
No, Mr. Crowe. Mrs. Cartwright saw the mummy you didn't want her to see. The mummy that you took from her house. The mummy that happens to be no mummy at all, but is, in fact, the body of her husband.
You know that?
That was why you hung a curtain in front of that mummy before we arrived.
And how did you know it was behind the curtain in my workroom?
Because of the glow of light around it. I could see that glow when the lights were turned off, so I took the curtain away completely. That was what made Mrs. Cartwright think it was moving.
Oh, I see. You are a very astute doctor. Could you tell me, perhaps, what you think made the misty glow?
That's simple. It was the natural body gases and fluids which you forgot to extract before you applied your preservative to Dr. Cartwright's corpse when you mummified
it. You are quite right. That was the only mistake I made.
There are certain things that you can't hide, Kroll, such as your bleached hair and beard. Your real name is Cavarella, isn't it?
Oh, so you are not only a doctor, you are a detective as well.
Well, you see, I knew that William Cartwright was one of the foremost Egyptologists in this country. And as such, he was often called upon to testify as an expert witness in many fraudulent cases connected with the culture.
So?
Yes. So I went through those cases with the district attorney on the assumption that one of those defendants was connected in some way with Cartwright's disappearance.
And the district attorney told you about me?
I found out that you'd been convicted in one of those and sent to prison for 12 years on the basis of Cartwright's testimony.
Oh, well, we all make mistakes, Dr. Crandall. Even you.
What do you mean?
That drink you just had. It was poisoned. And in a few more minutes, perhaps, you will be dead. But I promise you one thing. I will not make the same mistake on your corpse that I did on Cartwright's.
No, you... Oh, my throat!
You are beginning to feel the effect of the poison.
You can't get away with this. I'll come back after I'm dead.
I am not the superstitious one, Doctor.
I can't breathe. My throat!
Dead. And now, before Mrs. Cartwright can return with the police, as you have instructed her,
John!
I...
Jonathan!
Mrs. Cartwright.
Yes, I want to talk to Dr. Crandall. You've killed him.
Yes. And I am very glad you have returned.
What are you going to do?
Well, you see, I was just about to change Dr. Crandall's features completely so that I would not have a repetition of the same trouble. Although I did not want to kill him, I guess I was a little hasty. It was you I should have killed, my dear Mrs. Cartwright.
Patrice?
So you went out to call the police, eh? Well, they will never find out. Not with my way.
You'll find out you can't do this. You can't get away with
it. To the police, it will be just another disappearance. A disappearance caused by the curse of Ptolemy. People like to believe those things, Mrs. Cartwright.
No.
No. You can't do it, Crawl.
For you, Dr.
You didn't believe me, Crawl. I told you I'd come back.
John!
It's not true. It can't be.
You feel the pain, Crawl. The pain in your throat.
I feel it much more. Yes, I do. What is it?
In your chest, and now it's around your heart.
No, John. John. Yes, it is coming to my heart. I can't breathe. Oh, you... Choking!
Dead? John, you're alive. I don't understand.
I know how trying this is for you, Martha, but listen to me. I'll explain
it. But I just...
I wasn't dead. Crawl offered me a poisoned drink, but I distracted his attention by pretending to hear something outside. Oh. When he went to look, I switched the drinks, and he was the one who got the poison.
When I saw you there, I thought the mummy's curse had worked again.
No, Martha. That curse we talked about so much was only Kroll's own invention, and it came back to him. If he'd never thought it up, he would never have died as a result of it.
From shadows and stillness, mystery weaves a spell of strangest fascination, charging the mind with doubts and fears. For mystery is a strange companion, a living memory. In the haunting hour.
A Haunting Hour, on June 2 yesterday, a 1945 NBC syndicated broadcast. And that brings to a close this hour of horror on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's golden age. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Livonier. Thanks for tuning in.